traditional people have a hold of a truth that we set aside some thousands of years ago. It's not primitive. It's profound, and it is not part of the past. It's part of the future.
Welcome to Sacred Land Speaks, where we open the audio archives of the Sacred Land Film Project and revisit the interview clips we left on the cutting room floor over 40 years of filmmaking. I'm your host, Toby McLeod. Today we bring you part one of my 2011 interview with the award-winning author and my good friend, Barry Lopez. Barry Lopez's works include Arctic Dreams, for which he received the National Book Award, Of Wolves and Men, and his most recent masterwork, Horizon. Many remember Barry for his gift of storytelling, his generous spirit, and unyielding integrity. Sadly, Barry passed away in December 2020 following a long battle with prostate cancer. For me personally, his death has left a void of immense grief, as Barry was both a mentor and a lifelong friend. Looking back, I realize we bonded as storytellers, trying to make sense of both the astounding beauty of the world and the scale of human destruction. We wrestled with the task of authentic storytelling and a sense of responsibility to the people who entrusted us with their stories and to the natural world. Even though Barry was a non-native writer, we include his voice in this series on Sacred Land because there is so much to learn from his reflections on Western culture and his poetic meditations on relationship. The recordings you'll hear in this episode are from an interview I conducted with Barry in 2011 for our four-part film series, Standing on Sacred Ground. At the beginning of the interview, I asked Barry how his travels had shaped his approach to storytelling.
A statement that comes to mind for me often when I travel is to not try to solve a mystery when you go into a mysterious place, but to appreciate the mystery and stand in awe of people who live comfortably with it. I was traveling with Inuit people in northern Baffin Island, and in my studious way, I was making lots of notes about what was happening and what people were doing and animal tracks and the behavior of ivory gulls. And, you know, I had all of this going on, little notes in my little pocket notebook. And this man I was traveling with came over and put his arm around my shoulder, and he said, "Barry, you are always thinking." And it took a beat before I understood that it was an insult. He meant it as an insult. What he was saying is, by being so earnest in your effort to understand, you are thinking about something and not participating in it. And if you don't participate, all the thinking in the world will not bring you to an awareness of where you are. So that man was a guide for me in a matter of a few seconds. A guide in the sense that I never forgot what he was saying as a teacher. And that's the key to, I think, a way of traveling for me that works for me, where I long ago gave up the idea that I had to look sophisticated. I was just fine looking like a fool, because I knew if I opened myself up, I could look ridiculous. But, you know, who cares? And for me, as a writer, I'm not there for myself. I'm there for my people who couldn't go. And nobody's there watching who cares what happens to Barry, but I care about opening myself up, because if I didn't do that, I would leave thinking, I was never there. I went there, but I was never there. And that got me in the habit, I think, as a writer, of pulling out one word, one action of an animal, and put that in my notebook just so I could track myself at the end of the day. But to forget trying to understand what anything meant in the moment. Just try to be in it, to step into it and shut the mind off. Every sentence that shapes in your mind about something you've encountered is a way of collapsing a mystery into a reality, and that sentence is not the reality. It's only an approximation. So I think what I have had reinforced in me by trying to become vulnerable to a situation is pay attention. That's the first rule of everything. Listen, don't talk. Wait, be patient. Don't force anything. And don't ever look at the watch, you know, which I guess is the same thing as being patient. But it's amazing how, to me, how people can travel with guidebooks and, a whole suitcase full of paraphernalia to explain something before you've seen it, or to just cut off the process of who are you? The back and forth you have with the stranger, with a different world. I remember a time in the Brooks Range in Alaska. I spent a lot of time watching wolves with Nunamiut Eskimo people. And in the middle of this days-long exercise, I thought to myself, what would these men do if they came to my place? How would they behave in the mystery that is the Cascade Mountains in Oregon? And I said to this man, Jesse Akuk, I said, if you came to my place, what would you do? And he said, I would listen. And that was the whole thing for me. He was saying, don't impose a way of knowing on the thing that is fundamentally mysterious. Open yourself up, open your ears up, and let it come in. It's not going to happen in 1 minute. It'll take a little time. But the wider open you can make yourself, the more you will understand how a thing you've never known before is powerful beyond your understanding. When you go someplace you've never been before, shut up. Just listen.
Barry modeled this deep listening so beautifully. He taught me about the value of humility and how to quiet the self, to let the true nature of a place speak. And although it may seem small or insignificant, this practice of listening says so much about Western culture and the ways we've shut the door on the world around us in favor of imposing our own authority, our own way of knowing. A relationship with place that is all about speaking is inherently extractive, and we're seeing the failure of that approach unfold before us now. Barry always reminded me that there are other ways of being right on the edge of our consciousness, other worldviews that we might learn from, where relationship and connection are at the center of life.
An amazing thing for me about traditional people is that in the midst of what we would call poverty and hardship, women and men are still holding on to the principles and the wisdom that got them a lot further in time than our own country has gotten or Europe has gotten. I don't know how they hold on to that, these guiding principles. And it should be to our shame in the West that we turn our back on this and say these people are primitive, that people are far more sophisticated than we can afford to think, because what we've done is so racist, so self-important, so stupid. How can you throw a body of wisdom away because you think it's too difficult to understand? And when you travel around the world and you meet these cultures who've never heard of each other and they're saying similar things, how could you feel any sense but shame that you have been part of a system that has overpowered people who don't have weapons as sophisticated as yours, governments as nefarious as yours? economies as brutal and pitiless as our economy is, you'd have to say that you were not an educated person if you took up that position. It always seems so strange to me that people who call themselves educated can't be bothered to learn another language, can't be part of the bow of respect toward the unknown. What do you lose by showing respect for what you don't understand? What do you lose? Nothing. You have this sense that people are starving for intimacy, that they've created a culture in which the possibilities for intimacy are cut off in every direction. And the longing to be intimate with the world, with another person, is a palpable hunger. It's a hunger to hear a story that you can believe in. It's a hunger to be with someone whose initial reaction to you is not judgment, but appreciation. So, you know, if you let me get away with that, that there is this great hunger in Euro-American societies for intimacy, when you're in the landscapes that are defined by traditional people, there's intimacy of every sort. How did they get that? Or more importantly, what are they doing not to lose that? So intimacy requires vulnerability. You can't have intimacy with a person without being vulnerable. And in order to be vulnerable, you must trust. So we've created a society which is telling us at every turn, don't trust the corporation, the government, the whoever it is. And you develop this way of being in the world where you just don't trust anything. And you're afraid to be vulnerable. And if you can't open yourself up, the chances for intimacy disappear. You could posit that with intimacy comes strength. You know, to just the moment of being accepted for who you are, not judged, not compared to somebody else, but welcomed as a person. That is one of the ways in which we achieve a sense of self-worth and move out into the world with a sense of dignity. And people who feel their own dignity and a sense of self-worth can accomplish anything. And sometimes I think that is why, when you go into a village that outwardly seems to be distinguished by poverty of one sort or another, and the conversation or the situations, the love of parents for their children just sets your head on fire, I think that that is partly the result of not having lost a sense of self-worth and dignity and possibility. I used to ask people when I was in a strange place, I would say, so what does it mean to be wealthy? What would that mean for you? And many people gave me a similar answer. The first answer, almost always one way or another, was to have a family. And what I understood after a while, it wasn't having mom and dad and the grandkids, you know, all the rest of it, but having a place in which you were accepted for who you are, always, always. A woman said to me one time in a village, she asked me why I was sad, and I said, oh, I think I'm homesick. And she said, do you know that your home misses you? And when she said that, I saw for the first time my reciprocal relationship with my place. Yes, I know the birds at my place. Yes, I know the trees and the plants and how the soil feels underneath my feet. Yes, I know the smells of these different things. Yes, I know the sonic landscape of my place. But it had not occurred to me that my place knew me, and that when I wasn't there, it was saying, where are you? Where are you? And that's the moment in which I understood why so many traditional people, when you ask them to characterize our culture, say, lonely. You're lonely. And the question then would be, aren't you? And the answer is, no. Why? Because I am in a place. I'm not at a place. I don't live at this place. I live in this place. And its response to me is such that when I'm not here, there's an emptiness. And therefore, I know I am somebody. I'm not worried that I'm nobody, because I sense when I come home, my place says, what did you learn? Talk to us.
What Barry shared in this conversation about our relationship to home and being in a place really struck me. Although his written work wove a spiritual thread between humans and nature, he often approached landscapes more through the lens of a biologist. And I remember Barry was hesitant to speak on the notion of sacred land, fearing the tendency of our culture to fracture the sacred into strict binaries. If certain places are sacred, then what becomes of those deemed not sacred? Are they disposable? Of course, I was interviewing him for a film about the assault on sacred sites and the guardians of those places, and I think Barry felt the importance of that message enough to sit down for this interview.
It's so interesting to me that when you travel around the world and encounter groups of people who don't know anything at all about each other, that they have some things in common. I want to be very careful around that, because I don't believe all people are the same. I don't believe all people want the same things. But it does seem that all traditional people have this idea of empowered and empowering places with which they are regularly engaged. There's certainly a psychological component to it. I would say that there is a component at a physiological level. I couldn't articulate that, but I think it's there. When you talk about enduring cultures, cultures that have been around not for 100 or 300 or 500 years, but for thousands of years, and you see in each of these cultures a common element, a ceremonialized, ritualized, profound relationship with certain places, and we know that there is conversation between those places and those peoples, and we know that those peoples go to tremendous lengths to protect the sacred nature. So by that I mean no profane word, no profane act, no insult occurs in within the bounds of the sacred place.
I love this notion of empowered and empowering places, how in four words Barry could capture the reciprocity that is knitted into people's relationships with places of immense natural power. There is an ongoing conversation playing out between place-based people and their sacred lands, from which both draw a sense of empowerment and connection. Our modern culture completely discounts and suppresses this form of intimacy, instead focusing on the physical elements of land or the natural world.
I think it's difficult to talk to a Western audience about a sacrosanct place different from other places and have it understood the way traditional people, in my view, understand it. We're not really talking about something like a national park, a kind of iconic scenery, a big waterfall or imposing mountains or vast deserts. What we're talking about with sacred lands is a place of intense relationships, not the landscape as separate from the people who live there, but as a place so fully integrated with the people who live there that to separate it causes shock. You know who you are because you are in contact with this place. When you separate, psychologically, you don't know who you are. It's as though you've been thrown off centrifugally into space. You have no points of attachment. It's terrifying, terrifying to be out there. It's not exactly like a church. It's like a part of your being that's outside the epidermis. It's outside the skin. But it's no less a part of your essence than what's inside the skin, like your heart or your sense of smell. It's a place that raises the level of awareness about the mystery and power and possibility and joy that is present in life to a degree that almost can't be fully appreciated without fainting. So when you talk about sacred lands, you're talking as much as anything about the maintenance of a set of relationships, and that marriage, which is essential to life, is played out in art, it's played out in dance and ceremony, and it prompts you to think, in Western terms, of a trustworthy pattern for you to use when you have questions about how you should behave, what you should do, how do you take care of this issue. Your relationships with a sacred place are a guide to everything that goes on in your life, spiritually, psychologically, physiologically.
Rather than a set of relationships, dominant culture sees land as resource, something to be exploited, managed, and owned. This value system isn't just woven into the political and economic fabric of daily life, but lives within our very beings. And so it can be difficult to untangle from this culture of domination and repattern different ways of relating to land and to one another. Many people, myself and Barry included, often wrestle with the question, where did we as a culture go wrong?
We gave up in Euro-American culture. We gave up, I think, and then began to disparage and destroy the places that our ancestors held sacred because they were a reminder about how to behave that we did not see as productive. We saw that we could gain advantage if we destroyed the places that fed a certain kind of conduct in us. So I can understand why some people in Euro-American cultures want to destroy the sacred lands of other people to disembowel them and get them out of the way of our ideas of progress, a murderous notion. It's very hard to say, if you will, where did we go wrong, because the point is different for each person and each culture, and it happened probably repeatedly. But I think the sign of where it goes wrong is when the world outside the self is no longer the companion but the servant. And when you create a culture that looks at this thing we've created, which we call the natural world, as though we were not a part of it, when you separate humanity and the non-human, the tree, the bird outside the window, when you separate those things, you encourage a frame of mind in yourself in which you see the other as the servant or as a tool to create wealth for yourself. I've talked to you about this before, but I bring it up because it's such an important idea, Martin Buber's idea of the I-it relationship as distinct from the I-thou relationship. And our struggle, and the struggle of many other cultures now, is to get back to, if we've abandoned it, or stay in, if we've not let go, an I-thou relationship with everything. If you can move the natural world out of your moral universe, then you no longer have to be in an ethical relationship with animals, soil, air, water. It's a commodity. It's not a living, doesn't have any living essence to it, where you would, in a Christian sense, be sinning by harming that entity. But once you see a people as worthy of nothing but slavery and animals as worthy of nothing but a source of entertainment, amusement, or, I don't know, hunting for no reason except self-congratulation. You've got a culture that has put itself in a compromised position with regard to everything that is sacred. It's important to understand that if you are in a state of good moral relations with the world, that includes the world outside the self and outside the local human community. It includes members of the community that people in our culture would call just animals or nature or wildlife. We're fully involved with nature, but we're involved with nature in an exploitive way. Nature for us is a servant or a warehouse of natural resources that we use to increase the level of material wealth that we're comfortable with. You could not do that and not feel shame if you were in good relations with the place where you live or where you exist. I think that trying to understand the relationship between a particular group of people and what they identify as sacred land is a way of understanding a much larger problem, and that is the answer to this question: what is our moral relationship, or to put it another way, what is our ethical relationship to the world outside ourselves? When you go a long way down a bad road and you realize that you've made a turn somewhere back there that's not going to end well, you either have to turn around and go back down that road or ask a local resident if there is a parallel road and some kind of shortcut to get you on a different path. And that's what we're doing now, I think. We're going to traditional people and saying, we've noticed that a difference between your culture, which at a distance we admire, and our own culture, which is troubling to us, is that you have maintained a set of relationships with your places that we haven't. So could you talk to us about that, and maybe then we could see a way out of our predicament, because we don't have the energy, the time, the fuel, whatever it is, to go all the way back down that road that we've come down.
For me, Barry's words awaken the need for healing on a massive scale, with the places we call home, with the first peoples of the land, and with one another. This is by no means easy ground to navigate, but it is the work that's being demanded of each of us in this moment of cultural and ecological breakdown. We need models of reconciliation with integrity. We need leaders who bow down in humility, and teachers who can help us rediscover different ways of being in the world. And as we turn to tribal leaders, elders, community activists, and others who have held on to their sacred traditions for guidance, we must ask, how can we reestablish an ethical relationship with the earth without perpetuating a culture of extraction?
People are terrified of being alone. And I think the attractiveness that's there in the modern world between a group of people from a technologically sophisticated culture like ours, there is a sense, a loosely defined sense, that traditional people have a hold of a truth that we set aside some thousands of years ago and in this moment are realizing we've gotten ourselves into trouble by doing that. So they want to go, people want to go and apprentice in some way to traditional people to see if they can discover what it is that's missing in their lives. Sometimes it's sad that people are encouraged to believe that this is something you can accomplish overnight or on a trip somewhere and then you'll come back and you'll be a different person. It can't happen like that. But what can happen, and I think is the value of people in highly sophisticated, technologically speaking, cultures like ours, is by putting yourself in a place of respectful observation in a chair, a seat that is provided for you, not that you take, but is provided for you, and is often provided for you insofar as you show respect for what it is that you're witnessing. If you can take that step, the greatest thing probably that can happen for you in the moment is the rediscovery in your own culture of the things that you have abandoned. You cannot go and become part of another long-lived culture. But we're not that far from Magdalenian phase Cro-Magnon practice. And in that practice, in the place we now call Europe, are the roots of our ceremony, our shamanistic guidance, our size of social organization and governance, self-governance, that are the keys for us. So it, for me, I often think that if I travel with another group of people, it's not because I want to be like them. It's because of the things that as a human being I admire in the way they conduct themselves in the world. I want that for my people, and I know it is in my own people, and I want my people to rediscover that, to not steal something from somebody else, or to come as an invader or a false friend, but to come and say, I threw something away, and I am so full of grief and loneliness. Could you show me these few dance steps, and then I'll remember. And I'll go home, and I will go in the memory of my own people, and I'll discover the thing. But could you give me a hint? Could you give me a reminder? And then say, thank you, thank you. And do whatever you can after that to make sure that those people with no weapons, no backbreaking economy to intimidate others, to make sure that they're taken care of. I think that the obligation when somebody gives you something of the sacred so that you can recover your own sacred tradition creates an obligation to take care of the person who hung on to their tradition, to a human tradition, through every kind of miserable experience, from genocide to marginalization of a dozen different sorts. And that, to me, is the bonding that's taking place now between men and women in vastly different cultures, saying nobody has possession exclusively of what it is to lead a dignified, ethical, graceful life, but we can remind each other about the different ways to do it. And if we can just do that much, then we'll make these people whom we call the enemy, the figurative Visigoths of modern life, will make them irrelevant. We'll make them irrelevant. They will have no ground to stand on because we will be in possession of our own sense of dignity and self-worth, and that forms an insurmountable wall for those people that want to destroy us, whether it's us in our culture or small groups of traditional people isolated in villages where they don't have any protection.
What Barry shares here is so profound. We hold the tools of our own transformation and the creativity to shape a different future. And as Indigenous people have been saying for millennia, the protection of sacred land and cultural traditions is central to the movement for justice. In my work, this has meant making media that sparks action in defense of places and people under threat, like the Winnemem Wintu at Mount Shasta or the Lejean Ohlone at the West Berkeley Shell Mound. And a key piece of this effort is to educate non-Native people about why sacred lands should matter to them, why we all have a stake in this struggle.
We know that all over the world, traditional people go to extraordinary, extraordinary lengths to maintain the conversation that they carry on as a culture with the place that empowers them, from which they draw a sense of composure, of spiritual and psychological composure. They go to great lengths to protect that conversation. A person traveling around the world would have to say to themselves, isn't there some wisdom here? Yes. And shouldn't we look at protecting this part of the human heritage? Yes. Where is it for us? Do we have sacred places? As individuals, we probably do, but we have more historical places or places of vast and staggering scenery, like Yosemite or something like that. But we don't have sacred places in the same way that traditional people have sacred places, where ritualized, formal conversation that's distinguished by a speaker and a listener and a listener and a speaker that may go on for days. We don't have that. So we're trying to take care of places that have profound, profound meaning for a group of people. And it's a modern courtesy because of the way complicated modern life works that you and I, for whom that place is not sacred, mesmerizing maybe, and transfixing. Oh my gosh, we say when we enter a place like that, we can, but we also might miss it. But we know that it's sacred to a group of people, and a modern courtesy demands that we say, what can we do here so that you don't die? To my way of thinking, to destroy sacred lands is to murder a people. Because the relationships that are there, who am I? Where did I come from? Am I going to be all right? What is going to happen to my meaning, the meaning of my people in the world? To protect that, you have to protect sacred places. And we make a mistake if we think that by virtue of this idea that we believe is the right idea, progress, that we can dispense with sacred places. That's part of the past. Actually, sacred places are part of the future. And if they're not, we're in deeper trouble than we can imagine.
Though many of us may not have these kinds of relationships with the land, as Barry says, it's a grave mistake to expel sacred places from our moral universe. The immediate survival of indigenous and place-based people depend on them. And beyond that, they are part of our collective, resilient future. So as we wrestle with the magnitude of the task before us, perhaps the only way forward is to rediscover reciprocity with the earth, or as Barry might put it, to reignite a love of place.
Most of the time when you ask people, what is the opposite of love, they will say hate. But hate is not the opposite of love. The opposite of love is indifference. What that means is that an indifferent attitude towards something means I don't have any relationship with it. Whatever happens to it doesn't concern me. A loving relationship says there is a connection here, and if it breaks, both of us will suffer. So it's interesting to look at environmental issues not in terms of solely of love, but to see that the opposite of it is our attitude toward the natural world, which is, for many people, just indifference. Why should I care? Because we haven't made any effort to teach our children why they should care. We've let ourselves fall into a place where relationships with nature as adults have to do with sentimentality. But the mature relationship with nature is love, which is a word that's been compromised, to say the least, by various social movements in the United States since the 1960s. People are indifferent to the earth. What we have in front of us is an enterprise to repair indifference on a vast scale. and to see how it will become possible to make that feeling of indifference that characterizes our culture when it comes to what we call the land, and turn it into a loving relationship. A loving relationship is characterized by reciprocity. I give, I receive. I give, I receive. If you love someone and there's nothing coming back, that's not love, it's something else. And if you're not careful, it turns into a pathology. The reciprocal relationship is something that must always be nurtured, taken care of. Anyone who is married knows you must always check in with the other person and say, how are you doing? Or here's how I'm doing. You've got to tend to, it's got to be a caretaking relationship. An ongoing loving relationship has to be a conversation. And what traditional people, I think, say at so many junctures is you have to be talking to the earth and listening to the earth all the time. It's not like there's a book that somebody wrote and then nothing changes. There are lots of things that are changing that are part of natural cycles. And when these natural cycles come into play in such a way that they become visible to us, that's a good time to have another conversation with the earth about what's going on, what are you feeling, how am I feeling? Just to have a conversation, something that goes back and forth. So to remain in a loving relationship with the earth means keep that conversation going. And in times like we're living in, we've got to have a lot of conversation in a listening place, a place where the earth is really listening to you.
So what does it look like to re-engage or to sustain an ongoing conversation with the earth? As Barry suggests, the first step might simply be showing up, asking a question, and taking the time to truly listen.
There is a kind of prescription for each of us as individuals to discover what is the topic of this conversation. If the conversation is things are bad, how can we make them better? If that's what the conversation is, most of us have to discover what is that conversation when it comes to me and myself and the world that I live in. So many of us have been led down the path of the virtual reality that we don't realize we're not in touch with anything except things we've created, so that every reference is to ourselves. We don't stop to think that there's a world out there that's not virtual, that is real, and is indifferent to us, but with which we could have a reciprocal relationship. So a simple, although it seems silly, exercise is to simply walk out the door in the morning or open the window and say good morning to the light or to a bird that you just heard. Or it sounds naive, but it's actually profound, because it's the recognition of something outside the self. And so much of the pain that people feel is that in the end, the only reference they have is themselves. They harbor the thought that they could end up dead by the side of the road and it would be days before anybody noticed. And programming your gizmo in your hand or the television or something, it's all referring to you in a way that makes you sick after a while. And you have to open that door and step into the world and say, good morning, who are you? And wait for that response. So learning the names of birds that are resident in the place where you live, including cities, learning the geography of the place where you live, learning the rhythms of the weather that end up being what we call the climate, and taking note of how things are changing, and going and reading some records once in a while about how things were in the place where you live 40 years ago. It's the same thing you do when you fall in love with someone and you want the relationship. You want the relationship with that person, so you make it your business to find out who they are. Because in order for you to feel good, to get from that relationship what you want, what will feed you as a living being, you have to be in a reciprocal relationship. You have to respond to their question and ask them to respond to yours. So what you're trying to do as an individual is stop the conversation with yourself and begin the conversation with the world. And what traditional people are telling us is the conversation with yourself is a dead end. The only conversation to have is the conversation with the world. And it begins by saying, who are you? And waiting for an answer.
Barry left us with so many gifts, and this practice was one of them. I'm still learning what it means to be in conversation with the world. I will forever be a student, and I think in the end, that's what matters, that we continue to show up and embrace a practice, whatever that might look like for you.
Anything that you can do to develop a sense of intimate friendship with the world around you will help your whole psychological state, no matter what it is that you're doing in the world. And the more intimate you become with a place, the more courtesy and awe define the way that you relate to the world, the more you will understand what is this problem that people are talking about, and has a part of the dominant culture so worried, and has all traditional people worried. Isn't that an amazing thing? You have a problem, and all traditional cultures in the world are worried about it. But we're not? Wow. I don't know if I want to be on that side. Because clearly something is not working. And we're going so fast, and we're so deep in a state of denial that we think if we end the state of denial and we stop, we'll all die. But you know what? We won't. We won't if we enter into these reciprocal relationships with the world that is around us, you know. That's the whole business of knowing that if you fall down, someone will help you up. And too many people in this dominant culture of ours know that if they fell down, nobody would reach for them. Nobody would care. If the long-term effort is to discover for ourselves, or actually to rediscover for ourselves what it means to bring all of the world that is apparent to our senses into our moral universe, the first step would be to start listening and stop talking. The world that we have excluded from our moral universe has done us the favor of not walking away. They're still here. And they're still willing to talk. And we need to listen.
At age 74, in the midst of his battle with cancer, Barry finished what would be his final masterpiece, Horizon. I had the good fortune of doing one last interview with Barry for Earth Island Journal over the phone in the summer of 2019. We had originally set out to talk about the book, but our conversation quickly spilled over into the other corners of his amazing mind, grappling with human nature and the paradoxes of leading an ethical life. For me, this conversation reflected the arc of Barry's career and his ever-deepening sense of the profound fragility of life. A man looking back on his relationships and the art he had created. In so many ways, the interview captured his essence, warm, humble, and though a celebrated master in his field, always committed to listening. This last story you'll hear is from that phone call.
You know, I don't know if I ever told you this, but all of the time that I was writing Horizon, I'd get to places where I just fell down in failure thinking, how can somebody like you actually write this book? You don't have the skill, you don't have the intelligence, you don't have the experience. And I'd get up from my desk in that room, and I'd go down to the river and stand there because the space was open, you know, where the water is. I'd stand right at the edge of the water and try to put myself in a prayerful way. And I would say almost inevitably, I would focus on the bottom of the river and see beaver sticks there, sticks that have been stripped of their bark. They might be, you know, a 16th of an inch through the tip of a branch, or they might be 4 inches through and 2 feet long, massive, heavy objects. And I know there are beaver living in the bank in front of the house in the north bank. And in my mind, the sign of fresh beaver sticks there in the water was a sign that that the beaver were saying, just keep going. Just keep going. They're not going to commiserate with you. They're just saying, we're telling you, please, just keep going. And so I would take those sticks up to my room, and eventually there were hundreds of beaver sticks in that room where I was writing. And in that manuscript, the hand-edited manuscript, sits now in the guest house. It's on a chair wrapped in a beaver pelt with the last two beaver sticks I found on the day I was finished, lying side by side where the pelt folds over the manuscript.
Mm.
Now, no one, I think, you know, you've been through this, know enough about it to understand, but there it is, you know, some white person trying to learn a different way and taking advantage of the way the imagination moves without regard to anthropomorphization. And when the work was finished, I could not find the way to put that in the acknowledgement sections. I don't know. If I'd been more deft, I would have understood how to set it up, because it's very difficult to get white people to read that kind of statement and not be cynical about it or sentimental about it, to be able to say, I didn't write this book when I couldn't go any further. Beaver wrote the book.
Hmm.
Barry's story about Beaver has stuck with me since that interview. Amid political turmoil and climate chaos, Barry was saying to all of us, don't be distracted. Remember your purpose. Stay in your prayer. I have found a sense of groundedness in the simplicity of his directive. In our last phone call, 2 weeks before he died, Barry asked me to pass a message along to all of our friends, the community of artists and writers who love the earth and strive to protect all that is sacred. He said, just keep doing the work. Tune into the next episode of Sacred Land Speaks for part two of my interview with Barry Lopez. To browse an extended list of Barry's work or read messages from his friends and family in memoriam, you can visit his website at barrylopez.com. If you like what you've heard, please rate and subscribe to Sacred Land Speaks on your favorite podcast app. You can also visit sacredland.org to learn more about our films, resources, and suggested actions you can take to protect sacred places. This episode was produced and written by Hannah Wilton and Toby McLeod, edited by Callie Shanafelt Wong, and recorded by Isaac Butler Brown at Dirt Studios. Our film interview with Barry was recorded by Andy Black and Dave Wendlinger, along with co-producers Jessica Abbey and Jennifer Huang. Our theme music was composed and performed by Stefan Smith and Charles Johnson. Sacred Land Speaks is brought to you by the Sacred Land Film Project of Earth Island Institute, based in the Lejeune Ohlone Territory of Hoochoon, otherwise known as Berkeley, California. Thanks for joining us.